Our next speaker is a second-year grad student, Mark Raleigh. He's out of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering here. He studies snow hydrology, and I think you'll see his love of mountains and snow in his presentation. He's also the current UW student chapter president of the American Water Resources Association, and he's the president-elect of Engineers Without Borders, so this is a hope for our future here. Mark?
Thank you, Joan. Again, my name is Mark Raleigh. I'm a student of Dr. Jessica Lundquist, and I'm studying snow hydrology. The title of my talk today is Evaluation of Precipitation Scaling Using Snow Cover Disappearance Date. An alternative title might be The Seasonal End of Snowpack, Bad News for Skiers, Good News for Snow Scientists. As a native of Colorado, I'm kind of torn because I have been snowboarding for 10 years, and you know, when the snow disappears, that's bad news for me. But as a snow hydrologist, there might be an opportunity to use the disappearance date of snowpack in order to figure out how much snow and precipitation occurred over the year. And so that's really what I'm going to be talking about today. It's a method that has been used by others, but it has not been seriously tested or validated. So here's a brief outline of my talk. I'm going to talk about my motivation in studying this, the challenges of precipitation data, especially snowfall. And then I'm going to describe the exact method that others have used to reconstruct SWE or snow water equivalent. I'm going to then tell you some of the research questions I have coming into this project, and then discuss the study sites and data that I've used. And then I'm going to discuss the snow model that I used to calculate snow melt, and then metrics and results, tell you some potential applications of this method, and wrap it up with conclusions and future work. So here we are at the Water Center annual review. I don't need to be telling you that water is a very important thing. I would be preaching to the choir if I did. But I want to point out some very interesting things about snow and its importance to us in the Western United States. One half to two-thirds of the precipitation that occurs on an annual basis comes to us as snowfall in the mountains. And consequently, about 75% of the stream flow in the Western United States occurs because of snowmelt. Worldwide, it's about 40% of the stream flow is produced by snowmelt. So it's a pretty substantial amount of the water that arrives in our streams. And so therefore, snowfall and snowpack are critical components of the hydrologic cycle of the Western United States. One problem, though, when we're studying snow and snowfall is precipitation is very difficult to measure and to estimate. So at the point location, there's a number of issues that make it difficult. The first and probably foremost is the wind effects that prevent the exact amount of precipitation from falling into the gauge. The picture you see in the background is an upward view of a precipitation gauge on a roof. So here's the can. You also see a windshield that in theory should minimize the effect of wind on the gauge, but there have been a number of studies that show that there's still a substantial amount of undercatch that occurs. Especially with windfall, it's much more prone to not catching the right amount of precipitation. Some other errors that we have with our point measurements are in quality control. When you look at the data, there are some uncertainties as far as whether too little, too much, or a constant value may or may not actually represent what's actually occurring. Additionally, there's also improper gauge calibration and maintenance that make it difficult to get accurate point measurements of precipitation. The other issue with measuring precipitation, especially snowfall in the mountains, is that we do not have a lot of gauges throughout the mountains. Typically, the number of gauges is proportional to population densities. And as you can imagine, there aren't as many people in the mountains, and so accordingly, not as much precipitation is measured. Additionally, the gauges we do have are predominantly located in valleys, and so they may not be representative of what's occurring higher up or in different locations. So with precipitation, we only have really point measurements, and we have to essentially estimate what happens between those gauges. There's been a number of methods that have been introduced and used in order to do so. A couple I'm highlighting here are the Thiessen polygons. It's a classical hydrologic method of using a geometric approach to simulate precipitation over an area. Problem with it is it does not really accommodate topography, elevation, other characteristics that are important for precipitation. Others have used Hyota lapse rates, where there's a distinct relationship between elevation and precipitation. But again, there are other situations with topography that really does not perform as accurately as you would hope. Others have used interpolation schemes, kriging, or statistical and climatological models, such as the PRISM model that was developed by Chris Daly and others at Oregon State University. What you see in the lower right-hand corner is a map of the United States. This is a PRISM map that gives precipitation values on a 4-kilometer grid cell monthly value. One problem with PRISM is that it's a relatively coarse application. 4 kilometers might be too big for certain estimates of precipitation. So therefore, it's difficult for some applications and it's not necessarily applicable. So what I'm trying to say here is with all these different estimation methods, they struggle with accurately predicting how much precipitation occurs. There's no perfect method of estimating that precipitation. And when it comes to the mountains, the terrain is complex, and it makes it even more difficult. So instead of looking up at the sky when the snowfall is coming down, why don't we look down at the ground where the snow cover already is? Is there something there in the snowpack that might tell us how much fell there? So this is a question we're going to ask up front. Can it be used to improve our spatial estimates of winter precipitation? And the answer to that is others have tried to use it, and specifically they've tried to use when it disappears in order to predict how much actually fell there. So before I go too much further, I would like to just run over some very basic terminology that I'm going to be using throughout my presentation. The first of which is snow water equivalence, or SWE. And essentially what SWE is, it's the amount of water that is stored in the snowpack. It's a much better indicator of what's happening with a snowpack as compared to snow depth, because it tells us how much water is actually there. The density of snow varies, and so this is a very useful thing, specifically to water managers and other people who are concerned with how much water is in the snowpack. Another term I'm going to use is SCA, or snow-covered area, which essentially refers to the aerial extent of snowpack. Another term is ablation, which is a scientific way of saying snow melt. Another one I didn't list here was sublimation, which I'm assuming most people know, but it's essentially the phase shift from a solid, such as snow, into a vapor. Finally, the snow depletion or disappearance date is when SWE goes to zero at a point location or on a grid location. The SCA goes to zero or some other defined value when it is considered to be disappeared. So the SWE reconstruction method that I'm going to evaluate, as an engineer, I've decided it needs an acronym because everyone in the literature has not really given it one. So for my own purposes, I am calling it the Snow Depletion Date Scaling Method. And it basically uses the calculated snow melt prior to the disappearance date in order to figure out how much was there at the peak of the season. The SCDS method has seen application in numerous basins, the Himalayas, the Alps, the Colorado Rocky Mountains. However, in all of these studies, no one has made any attempt to test its validity. And so that's really the purpose of my research. The graph you see here on the left could be likened to a hydrograph. This is something we use in snow hydrology quite a bit. It's just looking at the SWE through time. So you could think of it as maybe a frozen hydrograph. It basically is the water stored through time in the snowpack. And so at this point here is when you would have peak SWE. And then after that is the spring onset, which is basically when everything starts melting and disappears there. The equation you see on the top right is the one that is used often in the literature. It essentially says that the SWE at any time, SWE n, so say here, is a function of the SWE at a previous time, so say here, minus the melt plus the precipitation. This is a very simple approach. It ignores, in this form, it ignores sublimation, which I will discuss later may be an issue. But it's useful for this method because if we define the system such that we want to look at this SWE here and the SWE at the peak, we know that at the location here, that SWE is equal to zero. And then if you rearrange the equation, you end up getting this. And so this is essentially the method, that the peak SWE is basically a function of all the melt water minus precipitation during the spring. So some questions I had up front were, how accurate is this method when I use temperature index ablation calculations? I'll explain in a moment what that exactly means. I also was curious to know, where does this work best, and exactly how sensitive is it to the exact day of snow disappearance? Depending on your scale, the point, or the grid cell, there is uncertainty as far as when the snow actually disappears. And additionally, with using this method, and using SNOW-17, it's a nonlinear system, so you can't always have it converge on the exact day of snow disappearance. So I was interested to know, how sensitive is it to that date? So for my validation study, I studied 144 different stations in Washington, Oregon, California, across 8 water years, 1996 through 2004, using NRCS SNOWTEL stations and California Department of Water Resources CDEC stations. You can see on the map here where the different stations are located. The data at each station typically were comprised of air temperature, precipitation, and measured SWE. This here is a typical station, you might say, of one of the study sites. At the base here, you can see, you may or may not be able to see it, but it's a snow pillow, and it essentially is a giant, think of it as a giant scale, just weighs all the snow, and it's coupled with the acoustic snow depth sensor. The combination of the depth and the weight will give you SWE, so that's how it is measured. You can see the precipitation gauge that is stationed up there. The reason why it's stationed so high, this is a site in California, because they get significant snowpack. So believe it or not, they could get 10, 15 feet of snow there. Finally, there's the air temperature sensor, which is shielded. And so that's how we get that. For the California sites, the CDEC sites, unfortunately, the precipitation data was not available. So what I ended up doing was using the relative increase in SWE and scaling that to be a sort of surrogate for my precipitation. And the other thing is, all this was done on a daily time step. The model I used for my snow melt was the SNOW-17 model, which is a temperature index snow model. And if you're unfamiliar with the temperature index snow model, you can take a look at the graph right here. This is essentially a way of calculating snow melt based on an index relative to the melting temperature. So, as you can see, it has a sinusoidal shape for this melt factor, which varies through time. So if you were, say, in March, and you had, say, 1 degree above the melting temperature, you would put you at around, say, in this ballpark. I'm kind of at an angle here, but it's around 3.2 millimeters of SWE for that day would be melted. So this is exactly how SNOW-17 computes its melt. It does not have an explicit treatment of sublimation, which may be an issue. We chose SNOW-17 because it's very simple, requires only air temperature, precipitation as input, and it's been used in a number of studies and is currently being used by the National Weather Service River Forecasting System. So how I combined SNOW-17 and this SDDS approach was basically by iterating on a snow correction factor, SCF factor. And basically what the SCF factor is a simple scaling factor that multiplies on the precipitation before the precipitation goes into the model. So if you look at the figure here, you can see different SCF factors, 1, 1.5, and finally 1.28. And this is just, again, just different amounts of precipitation being put in the model such that it will disappear on this observed date. So really what we're trying to do is make the simulated snow disappearance match what was actually observed. And then this is really, if this method turns out to be useful and reliable, this is a way of figuring out exactly how much precipitation fell somewhere. We could have a factor relative to a base precipitation station. So that's really how this could be useful if it is reliable. The metrics I used in this study were very simple, just the volume ratio, which is essentially the area under the curve, under the SWE curve, modeled versus observed, and then also looked at just the simple peak SWE of the season, so again, modeled over observed. Finally, also looked at the timing of the peak SWE just to see what sort of performance there was there. I'll give you a couple different results just to give you some samples. The one on the left demonstrates a nearly perfect run. You have a volume ratio of nearly 1, peak SWE ratio of nearly 1, and you should be able to see that they follow each other fairly closely, they match at the same date, and the peak hits pretty well on. So that would be a very ideal situation. One on the right, however, is one of our less ideal situations. The blue dotted line is the simulated, the black solid is observed. As you can see, severely underpredicts both the volume and the peak SWE. So that's an issue in some cases. A few other examples, these are from Oregon and Washington, where you did very well with one metric, but not quite as well with the other. So on the one on the left, you can see the volume, which is, again, the area under the curve. The volume ratio is essentially one. So what you see here is that it predicts too much in the beginning and not enough at the end. So it does okay with the volume, but just with the timing of it, it just doesn't do so well. The one on the right, you can see the peak SWE ratio is near one, but you can see some definite problems here. It matches the peak, but underestimates in a lot of other locations. So there's a number of circumstances here to consider when looking at the results. I've tabulated my results in the form of box plots. If you're not familiar with them, this is essentially like a histogram. I've parsed it out according to 300-meter elevation bands. So this would be from 600 to 899. This would be 900 to 1199 and so forth. The box itself has a line in the middle that represents the median value. And then the edges of the box are the 25% above, 25% below. And then the whiskers over here are 25% beyond that. The crosses represent outliers in the data. And the other thing to point out is that I've labeled how many samples were in each elevation band. So what you really see here is that 80% of my realizations were in this area. So that's where I'm going to focus most of my analysis with the results. And what you can basically see is that there is quite a bit of spread. This is for the volume ratio. You could have as little as, say, 0.3, 0.4, up to 1.5 times the volume of observed. So that's quite a bit of range. You can also see that there is a somewhat declining values of the volume ratio as you go up in elevation in time. So the spread is not necessarily promising as far as how well this actually worked. There's a very similar story for the peak SWE ratio. Again, quite a bit of spread in the values. And in general, it underpredicts how much peak snow water equivalence there was. Finally, if you look at the peak SWE timing, you can see even more variability, as much as 50 days before or 25 days behind, and anywhere in between. And there's no necessarily obvious trend here. So it seems to misplace the peak substantially in some circumstances. So when using this SDS method with the temperature index ablation, it appears that it underestimates. If you look at just the mean, the overall mean, the numbers look okay. The SWE volume is underestimated by 16%, peak SWE by 17%, and even if you look at just the overall median, the peak SWE is underestimated or simulated only one day earlier. So if you look at it just by those numbers, it's okay, but what you need to know with this is that there's a lot of spread. And so that really takes away from the robustness of this method. The other thing I need to mention, though, however, is that when using SNOW 17, I had not calibrated the model for the 144 different sites. I had used just one calibration from a basin American River Basin in California. And so accordingly, there may be some issues here with SNOW 17 as far as calibrating the model for different melt factors and things like that. So that's something I'm going to talk about in my future work, but this is just sort of a first look sort of situation. A few other things I mentioned is that the lower elevations tend to overestimate SWE, higher elevations tend to underestimate SWE, and finally, I didn't show really a graph of this, but we did a sensitivity analysis and found that the results didn't really change as long as the snow disappearance was matched within plus or minus 2 days. So I'm going to do a little sidetrack here and just talk about some potential applications, assuming we can make this method work with different melt calculations or with some other considerations. The first one is with using remote sensing. And what you might see on the right there are MODIS images. MODIS is a satellite that is mounted on the Terra satellite from NASA. It provides a 500-meter daily resolution of fractional snow-covered area. And you can see this is actually our state here about a month ago. And I think you should be able to see the red on the bottom, but what you're basically seeing here is a mix of between clouds and fog, as well as snow. And then it uses a different different band in order to actually find where the snow is. So the red is actually where the snow is. It's not all right there. So I'm just throwing it out there in case you hadn't seen notice before, that it can discriminate between clouds and snow cover. But some other challenges that MODIS faces are with forest canopy. It has a difficult time seeing underneath, and there has been documented some considerable error in how much snow it sees underneath forest canopy. Additionally, viewing angle and topography might limit its ability to see within valleys or other areas where there's some complex topography. And finally, well, I guess one thing I should say with this is, since it is taking daily imagery of fractional snow-covered area, you could see when the snow disappears within a grid cell. So that is actually exactly how you would get the snow disappearance date. The problem then with running the SDDS method is the age-old question of how you represent hydrologic processes on a grid scale. It's a difficult thing to do, and there are some issues there to consider. But this is a potential application if those can be worked out. A second application is one that has been developed by my advisor, Dr. Jessica Lundquist. If you look on the left here, you can see a little schematic of what we do with these little Maxim iButton temperature sensors. They're about the size of a dime, relatively cheap, $30 or so. And what we do is we bury one in the soil, only a couple inches down, and then put one in a tree with a radiation shield. And from this, once you find the temperature sensor, you'll get a record that looks like this. You'll have fluctuations in air temperature, and then when the snowpack arrives, it insulates the record and it keeps it isothermal at 0 degrees. That provides a signal for when the snow cover is and allows you to see when the snow disappears. By having the paired air temperature sensor, you're also able to run Snow 17, since you now have the snow disappearance date as well as a temperature record. Lower right-hand corner shows the American River Basin where I'm currently working, and the white dots are essentially locations where I've set up the situation. One challenge, though, is you have to go find these sensors, which, if you take notes and take GPS coordinates, is usually pretty good. So to summarize my presentation, the SDDS method using temperature index ablation calculations is at best moderately successful at predicting snow water equivalent and thus winter precipitation. However, there needs to be more consideration with potential model calibration. For future work, again, I need to calibrate the model further. I would also like to look and see how the model performs using hourly versus daily calculations of snow melt. More importantly, I would like to compare how the temperature index approach compares to the physically based full energy balance model, which actually calculates radiation. It uses measurements of radiation and sensible and latent heat fluxes, those sorts of calculations, which may provide a more realistic approach of snow melt. Finally, we need to explore methods of interpolating, extrapolating between stations and using this method. And then we also need to compare the ground sensors versus the MODIS imagery to see how they compare with the snow disappearance date. So this time I'd like to just acknowledge the NOAA HMT project, which I've been fortunate to work upon for the last year. Also the help of Dr. Jessica Lundquist and her research group. Finally, for the feedback from Noah Maloach and Dr. Stephen Burgess. And I will take questions at this time. Is that your hand up, Ted? Good question, Ted. And that's actually something in my future work I would like to do is use something like Utah Energy Balance. A full energy balance model will definitely calculate melt differently, and it might be the reason why it is underestimating snow melt. And those models are also advantageous because they require very little calibration, which, like I said, could be the problem with using Snow 17. So yes, it is something I'm considering doing in the near future. One problem up front, though, is it often requires more parameters such as relative humidity, wind velocity, radiation measurements, which aren't taken on as broad of a scale as just the simple temperature and precipitation. But it is, yes, something I would like to do. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Let me ask this question. I don't mean this to offend you, but I'm concerned that in hydrology, I've been working for 3-some years, and the HSPF model is in the infancy, and there's all this calibration and all this data that we need. And I've been reading recently there's this artificial neural network technology where you can take a couple parameters and come up with a hydrogram. And it doesn't explain the processes. So if all we want is a hydrogram, why don't we simplify it, take the data we own, get the answer we need to do the job, and not worry about physical processes. And spend all this money, I would suggest you're never going to get all the research calibration data you need. Mm-hmm. Take what you know and apply it using mathematical models. And put statistics on it. It's kind of like the regional regression analysis that they used to do in the 70s. I've shown my age. So. But it's interesting, but I don't think you're going to ever get a calibration where you're understanding the model. And I think we're overanalyzing things. And I would suggest that you look at using what you can and figure it out how you can simplify it. So create the rational model for someone. Mm-hmm. And maybe some years you'll understand the processes, but I don't see it happening real soon. So
okay.
I challenge you to figure out a simpler way to model.
Okay. Well, thank you for the feedback. Part of this was because others have already used this in studies, the temperature index approach. So it's something I wanted to evaluate, and that's kind of what it necessitated. But I agree, something more physically based would be, I think, something we should pursue.
Do you want to give a quick plug for Engineers Without Borders?
Sure. Okay. And the one other thing, as Joan had mentioned when she introduced me, I'm the president-elect of Engineers Without Borders. This coming Monday, we have our annual fundraiser, Dessert and Wine. And if you like either or, you may be interested in coming. It's 6 to 9 p.m. Walker Ames Room. It's a very fun time. I would hope you'd have fun. And a lot of people have really enjoyed it before. But it's really our big fundraiser, and it's how we have projects in Bolivia and potentially Suriname. And we've had quite a bit of success there. So please consider coming if you would like. Thanks.
And bring your checkbook, right, Mark?